Consumer and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is Tuesday, September 16th, 2014, and we're convened for the purposes of hearing an update on patient choice notification, Senate Bill 683 from 2013, as well as for an update on the Oregon rate review process. And for the most part, we're going to go in the order listed on the agenda. However, Dr. Chris Altenhofen from Epic Imaging will be calling in, or we will be calling to him, at 2:20, time certain, because he is busy seeing patients. Chana, why don't you tee it up for us?
Certainly, Chair Shields, members of the committee. The first item on the agenda is Senate Bill 683. That passed out of this committee with unanimous vote in 2013. It requires healthcare practitioners to give notice to patients of the patient's choice to go to a different provider if the patient is being referred out for certain services. It also requires the practitioner to give notice of a financial interest if they're referring a patient to a particular facility in which the practitioner has a financial interest. This went to a rulemaking process, and it had multiple drafts of rules, and we're here for an update.
All right, thank you, Janice. Suzanne Huffman, please. And Courtney, yes, feel free to come up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Suzanne Huffman, and I'm the interim director of the Oregon Health Authority. And I was asked to come today to talk about our administrative rules process with regard to Senate Bill 683. And can give you a brief explanation of where we've been and where I believe we are. And with me is Courtney Wessling, who's our Director of Government Affairs and has been following this process pretty much all along the way, and so can fill in the gaps and perhaps also answer some questions if you have them. So I can tell you that I came into this role in May of this year, at which time stakeholder groups were providing some feedback to me, to Courtney, to the governor's office, and asking me to please address their concerns with regard to rules that apparently became final just as I was coming into this role. The stakeholders who provided input to either to me, to Courtney, or to the governor's office were included Providence, Legacy, the Hospital Association, the OMA, as well as Senator Bates, Senator Steiner Hayward, and Representative Greenlick. So as I began to familiarize myself with the events to date regarding the rules process, I learned that there had been a Rules Advisory Committee, which is recommended and encouraged under the Administrative Procedures Act. And for some time, the agency has had a policy that we will always have a Rules Advisory Committee, and that it actually requires an exception request to the director of the agency not to have one. So Rules Advisory Committee was the practice for this process as well. I was informed that it was a very challenging and contentious Rules Advisory Committee process, and that no agreement was reached among the various participants. And it looks like there was a fair amount of drafting and review and comments coming in related to those drafts. And I believe that the minutes as transcribed from those meetings has been provided to you. My predecessor in this role, Acting Director Tina Edlund, made the final decision about the rules that were ultimately filed, and I spoke with her. She shared with me that as she got updates from staff about the lack of an agreement among the Rules Advisory Committee members, that what she was trying to do was strike a balance, meeting both the timely and meaningful part of the law, as well as the administrative simplification or minimal burden, as well as not interfering with any use of EHRs. It appeared to her that the place to be would be to align it with the practices around HIPAA notification as much as possible, because folks already have infrastructure in place to do that. So that's where she was trying to head with that final rule. The feedback that I was getting from people who contacted us was that we didn't quite hit that mark, and that, in fact, the frequency of notice that was being required and the methods of the way the notice would be required was both administratively burdensome and therefore out of alignment with the law, and was going to interfere with the current construct of their electronic health records and be a significant expense to make changes there. So what I did at that point was to put in place, with guidance from Courtney and from our technical rules staff, in accordance with the Administrative Procedures Act, was to temporarily suspend part of the rule, not the entire rule. That is still in place, and I think we've sent copies of that and provided them today. But the part of the rule around that seemed to still be in dispute, especially after talking with former Acting Director Edlund, that perhaps the final language didn't even meet what she was trying to strike there. So I temporarily suspended the part about the frequency and the manner in which the notice would be done, so that we could come back together in another Rules Advisory Committee, and I would have the opportunity to receive that feedback through that public process before issuing final rules once again. And so that's my understanding of where we are, and I'll ask Courtney to please insert anything you think I might have missed or anything I didn't get quite right.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, Courtney Westling, Legislative Director at Oregon Health Authority. I think you hit most of the timeline pretty well. If there are questions about when and all of that, I'd be happy to take them or help answer them.
Senator Baird Sugar.
You know, when we passed this bill out of committee, if I remember right, everybody voted for it, didn't we? Yes. And I think the intent was that we wanted to make sure the patient knew they had other options. Okay? And as we go through this, I think that's still our intent, is to make sure the patient knows they have other options. And, you know, I was a little disappointed that this rules kind of got fouled up. And that's okay. Life's not perfect. But we need to figure out how to create these rules with the intent of what we did this bill. Mm-hmm. So let's get it done. That's kind of my standpoint. Let's get it done.
Ms. Hoffman, so you got feedback from the side that felt like they didn't get all that they wanted in this rulemaking process, and after it was completed, complained. Did you also reach out to the other half of the rulemaking process, who frankly also didn't get all of that they wanted, and to see what their point of view is on rescinding the rule?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, I've not spoken with anyone other than the list of people that I named. I don't know if you have.
Senator Shields, members of the committee, we heard from some people expressing concern. There were some people that didn't speak up at a certain point, but we didn't proactively reach out to anyone. They came to us.
Okay.
But all members of the RAC were very vocal throughout the process on either side.
And it was my intent to, as we pull the Rules Advisory Committee back together, to be able to hear that feedback mm-hmm. directly in this role.
Okay. Yeah, Senator Przanski.
So what's the schedule in the sense of, I'm just trying to figure out, mm-hmm. I understand there's been a suspension. I thought I heard that trying to get everyone back together. Mm-hmm. Is there a blueprint for where and when the next meeting's going to be and how that's going to go?
Yes, Chair Shields, Senator Przanski. The temporary rule is only good for a period of 6 months?
Through January.
So we work back from that deadline and make sure that we put the processes in place to be able to have this resolved before then.
And all the people that you talked about who were dissatisfied, mm-hmm. they all had some representation, some in some form or fashion, at the Rural Advisory Council, right?
Senator Shields, I believe Legacy, I don't think Legacy was a member of the Rules Advisory Committee.
Was the Hospital Association
yes,
there?
Yes, the Hospital Association.
And is Legacy
was.
A member of the Hospital
yes.
Association?
To my knowledge, it is, yeah.
And I think we can also assume that Legacy knew that the rulemaking process was happening. Mm-hmm. So did you ask for any evidence of this, you know, large administrative burden?
Senator Shields, members of the committee, I did not.
Have you seen any evidence of it?
Not yet.
Okay.
It's simply been described to me.
At this point, when you mentioned HIPAA and that putting it in line with HIPAA seemed to make sense to you, can you talk about what that might look like?
Senator Shields, members of the committee, I'll certainly consult with our Assistant Attorney General that has a great deal of expertise in that. But the way it was described to me by former Acting Director Edlund was that there is a notice, a one-time notice upon the first visit, as well as clear postings in easy-to-see places in the facility or in the office, that would be a minimum requirement.
And you think signing that piece of paper right at the beginning in all the disclosure forms would be meaningful?
Senator Shields, members of the committee, that would be the goal. I know that one of the concerns that Acting Director Edlund had at the time that was that a one-time notice may not be sufficient, but what is the right frequency? So one of the considerations that she was thinking through was one-time notice, yes, but what if I don't need a referral for 5 years, and 5 years later I come in and I don't necessarily remember that I was told that I have other options? So she was trying to strike a balance between not necessarily moving to every time you see a person, but what would be the right level of frequency to ensure that the patient has awareness of that right.
Okay.
And again, trying to align with HIPAA in a way that people could use their existing infrastructure and not necessarily have to modify their electronic health records to be able to accommodate it.
Mm-hmm. Now, wasn't the other option that through the rule that they could just put a poster? There were basically three ways that they can meet the meaningful. One would be through oral, which is, I think, what the small businesses that have been affected by some of these policies wanted this, that the, mm-hmm. you encourage communication between the provider mm-hmm. and the provider would actually tell the patient, hey, I'm going to refer you to this place, but you've got other options. There was a lot of resistance to that. Then the second part was you could put it in, it could be in the paperwork, mm-hmm. but it also had to happen upon the time of referral. And then the third was just that there could be a poster. And so there are three different options. I just want to make sure that you were aware of that.
Yeah, Senator Shields, members of the committee, one of the errors that we discovered as we were suspending part of the rule and putting the temporary rule in place was that we were less than clear, and the intent was to have it be written or oral, and we had left out the words or oral. So we have added that as a part of the temporary rule. Presume it would probably go on to becoming permanent, since I don't think there was much disagreement about that aspect. And then the posting was a separate requirement, so it would be in addition to. I don't think it was ever seriously considered to only have a poster on the wall, for example.
Hmm. Do you have the rule in front of you?
Yes.
And can you show me the, I don't have it in front of me right now.
Can you identify the rule by number so we'll have it on the record?
And where that is that indicates that the poster couldn't work by itself.
Do you want the current rule?
No, the one.
The original.
The original that you put into place.
Yeah, so the original 333-072-0215 the portions that were temporarily suspended were numbers under requirements for notification of patient choice.
Can you give us numbers, please? I mean, I've got the rural 215, but then under there it says sub 1, 2, 3, and then A, B, and C, which I just like to have a record.
It's sub 3.
Okay.
And everything under number 3, A, B, sub A and B, as well as sub 4, sub A and B under that, were removed.
So I assume what we have here is the current temporary rule.
Right.
Available on the list. Okay. So I'm confused. Where's the part about the posting? And
so that's down at sub 6. In addition to providing notice of patient choice at the time the patient establishes care with the practitioner, starts with that.
Yeah. Hold on, I'm looking at the wrong document.
Practitioners shall post notice in a conspicuous location. And so all of number 6 was removed as well, and to be revisited by the Rules Advisory Committee so they could address the type of notice and the frequency all together.
Okay.
And then we added new number 3, the written, and we added or oral notice of patient choice because we had missed those two words, or oral,
in the original filing.
And our feedback we got was, I thought we agreed on either or, and I don't see the words there clearly. So we took the opportunity in this temporary filing to add that in.
And did you, but you didn't consult with the other partners in the rulemaking process?
No, we've not reached out to anyone, as Courtney said, only people that contacted us.
Yeah. Okay.
And of course, provided notice to all parties pursuant to the Administrative Procedures Act.
Okay. And Representative Thatcher had expressed some interest in this topic as well. Is there any comment you need to make? I know you're in another committee.
Yeah, just briefly, I have a constituent who, though I was not involved in the development of this bill last session, or I think it was last session, I remember it coming to the House floor, and I remember it making sense, because it makes sense to keep true choice, competition, you know, availability, access for patients, you know, available and make everything accessible. And it seems like we're maybe going backwards after rescinding this, because I think what was said here is that we need to make sure that people know that they have that choice, and I'm not, I guess I'm a little disappointed that's kind of being backpedaled upon at this point. So
okay, thank
that
you.
Was it.
Good. So we need, I'd like you all to stay there if you would. We're going to call in Dr. Senator Bearchiger.
Go ahead. I'll say my question if you're going to keep them up here.
Yeah, that, we
that'd
are.
Be great.
We're
going to
call in Dr. Alton Hoffer. Hoffman. He's the medical director of Epic Imaging. And one of the challenges, Ms. Hoffman, is that everybody who had representation that didn't feel like they got all that they wanted have
Hello?
People that can be paid to come to these where the other parties do not. Hello, Dr. Alton Hoffman?
Yes.
This is Chip Shields. You are live at the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. We have in front of us Suzanne Hoffman, the interim director of the Oregon Health Authority, as well as Courtney Thompson, who is with the staff. Courtney, actually, your married name.
Westling,
thank you. So if you could just feel free to give us your testimony regarding the Patient Choice Notification Act.
Sure. And so my name is Christopher J. Alton Hoffman. I am the medical director of Epic Imaging in Portland, and I was on the Rules Committee about this bill. I thought I'd just start out this testimony by pointing out on September 24th, there is a healthcare conference in Portland. The Oregon State of Reform Healthcare Policy Conference features business and government leaders, including representatives from the governor's office, Senator Demonis Anderson, Dennis Richardson, and a number of other people. And one of the talks on that agenda is empowering patient choice. So it is a timely topic, and it's getting attention from, you know, the highest levels of the industry and the government. I was going to touch briefly on what I view as the original intent of this bill as it was set out originally. It was meant to address some real and regular abuses, really, by some providers to limit patient choice with efforts, usually successful efforts, to keep or redirect patients into hospital corporation systems and limit patients' choices and access to alternative providers who might be able to provide more timely, cost-effective, and personal care for the patients. Basically, you know, to sum it up, it's dealing with the well-known fallout of a well-known idea that's been around for a long time, the, quote, corporate practice of medicine, where hospital corporation interests intrude upon and take precedent over the patient's best interests, as well as directly with the doctor-patient relationship. And I've said it before, and I'll remind people that it's for this very reason that the state of California continues to ban what they call the corporate practice of medicine in that state. The rulemaking process, which I was involved with, I think it went on longer than people anticipated. It was a bit more contentious than people realized it was going to be. But in the end, after many meetings, many drafts, many email exchanges over several months, you know, a fairly thorough and rigorous process was gone through, and at least it was felt from my end that what was achieved was a compromise of sorts that was aimed at addressing a couple of points that really kind of stuck on people. One of them was meaningful notification, as was outlined in the bill. And of course, there were several opinions on what meaningful meant, but in the end, it felt like what was finally established really did provide the patient with timely notification at the time of referral. And there was also a lot of discussion about documentation concerns, about whether providers could adequately document whether meaningful notification was given. And so I guess I want to stress today that, you know, through that whole process, I felt like it was pretty involved, pretty thorough, and involved quite a bit of discussion from, you know, all the parties and stakeholders involved. And so, you know, I was really quite surprised to receive an email notification where a lot of the points had been rolled back and without input or discussion, any further input or discussion on that point. And it kind of left me wondering about what the whole effort was for. And I was disappointed to see it end up that way.
All right. Hey, questions? Senator Mona Sanderson.
Hi, thank you for joining us. I have a question on a circumstance that actually happened to me, okay? I was having double vision. The ophthalmologist, I went to my ophthalmologist. I was referred, had to go through my primary care, get a referral, went to my ophthalmologist, and my plan is with PEB Providence. So they said I needed an MRI, so I said, okay, and they said I would need to have it at the hospital, and I said, could I have something closer to where I live, and they said that would be out of network, and I would have to pay a lot more money. Is that the kind of situation that you were wanting, since, you know, you're in my area? I wouldn't have been able to go to you because I would have, you know, I have a plan and I want my plan to cover it, so I'm naturally going to go to an in-network, and I certainly didn't want to take the time to find out if you were out of network or in-network. So I think it's really a lot more complicated for those of us who are users of the system when it
yes,
comes
I
to choice.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. Actually, between Epic and Providence, there's a long history with this particular issue. I think the bill was really aimed at it. They'd even stipulated that, you know, it's within the confines of what your insurance policy will allow. And so it's Providence has their own plan, and, you know, they don't allow a lot of out-of-network providers unless you pay that extra cost. You know, that's kind of accepted, but it's, from, at least from my take and my understanding on it, it was dealing with a lot of non-Providence health plan patients who go to Providence doctors, but are then tried to be redirected into the system when they could come to see a different provider outside of Providence. We would love to be providers for Providence. We were for 30 years until we were kicked off of their plan, and that was several years ago. And for years, we would offer to match your in-network benefits. But over time, with healthcare reimbursement cuts, it just has become less feasible for us to actually offer that as a blanket policy to all Providence patients. So, but I think the original intent of the statute was meant to was not trying to supersede your own insurance policy itself and who it includes in the network or not.
Well, to me, as a patient, I had enough savvy to ask the question, and the people were very upfront now as to my choice. But I think it would be very confusing for a patient needing to have an MRI to try to start hassling, or not hassle, but figure out, okay, well, should I go here or there, when I would have no idea, or the patient would have no idea where to go. So that's one thing that I would hope that these rules were, is to have it be very simple for the patient, because they're concerned about getting the service delivered. They're not necessarily concerned about where they go. So whatever is the outcome, it really needs to make, we need to make sure it's going to be simple for the patient, as well as to be administered easily.
Well, I mean, we do know that there are patients who have come here and switched insurance and then have been told that they can't come here, but they can. And, you know, those are some of the things that we're trying to address through this, is that that those patients shouldn't be misled into thinking that they can't go to a different provider when their insurance company will actually allow it, you know, separate from the Providence Health Plan. And there are lots of patients who ask if they can go somewhere else, and in some instances, they've been told no when they actually are able to.
Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I guess the one thing that I'm hearing you say at this point, I'm not sure if the notification would actually cover that. It's one thing for them to, meaning a patient, to get the notification. It's a second thing for someone to tell that patient, no, you can't do something, even though that lawfully they could. It seems to me that we would need to be addressing the intentional misleading, I guess I'm going to say, as compared to the notification. Am I misunderstanding what you're stating?
Well, with the notification, you're up front telling the patient that, you know, you are free to choose your provider, provided that it's within the within your insurance policy, that that provider is covered in your insurance policy or is in network. And, you know, there is that burden then on the patient to they can make the decision or not whether to seek you know, care elsewhere. They can go through the effort of contacting their insurance company, to see where they can go. Like I've said in many instances, the patients, you know, these the cases that become aware are the ones that want to go somewhere else and then are told that they're not. And at least through the notification process, they are told up front that it is actually their choice and they cannot be not denied by the referring doctor of going to see a different provider as long as their insurance company will cover it.
Okay. Any other questions for Dr. Altenhofen? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. We will continue to stay on top of this and try to figure out the right path to go. Thank you for your testimony.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Okay, so then, as long as we still have you guys up here at the dais, are there any, you had a question?
Yeah, well, more of a comment.
Okay.
You know, digging through my file of when we went through all this, you know, I always refer back to that, you know, our intent was to require healthcare practitioners to refer patients to facilities basically solely on consideration of the patient's needs and personal health choices. And, you know, I said that was the intent. We're unanimous. It passed. And we have to depend on you and the other partners to come up with the rules and the logistics and all that. We don't understand all the I don't understand how healthcare records transfer. I don't understand. So we have to depend on you folks to do it. But yet we're sitting in a hearing saying it didn't get done. And I'm just a little bit amazed. I think, you know, I've got a few other issues I could be working on right now. This should have been dealt with. And I really appreciate it if you just go back to the drawing board and come up to something that we're, I don't think it's that, you know, unless I'm missing something, I just don't think it's that hard. So that's my strong suggestion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Sanderson.
Yeah, I really do. And I think that the intent is that it really needs to align with the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It needs to be in concert with the transformation and the new clinical models that are coming forth. I don't want a huge administrative burden on the providers. It needs to be streamlined. And so I think the intent with why the rules were rescinded was so that a significant administrative burden wouldn't happen to the providers. I'm not sure. Anyway, that's my 2 cents worth.
Well, I think regardless, I think it would have been fair for you to consult with the proponents of the bill before you rescind that rule. I think that, and I think my understanding when we're talking about HIPAA is that, I mean, it in some health systems, you don't even see the form you're signing anymore. You actually just sign it, and then they say, would you like a printout of that? And most people probably say no. Now, if I have a hard time getting to the point that that's meaningful, that meaningful discussion about you having choice when all you're doing is signing your name to something that 50% of all people probably don't even print out. So I think, you know, going through with the rulemaking process is interesting. This also might be something where, unfortunately, we might just have to open up this can of worms again as a legislature. All right. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. Could we bring up Dr. Doug Walta and Jessica Adamson?
Somebody's glasses.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Doug Walta. Let me, and what I'd like to do today is just to present from my perspective, based on my background, where the current market is, where the federal state recommendations are taking us, and provinces' involvement in the process. So first of all, I'm an old man. I came in practice in 1975. I'm a critical care gastroenterologist, complex endoscopist. And I practiced for 35 years. I was president of the Oregon Clinic at its inception, so I understand healthcare policy a lot. And I did that for 10 years while practicing full time. So you can argue pros and cons of that. I retired at the age of 64 for a reason. I wanted to stop when I was at the top of my game because the last thing I wanted to do was hurt a patient. And I got convinced that I should participate and work with Providence. So at the present time, I couldn't, it's kind of like not controlling your future. I end up accountable for all the clinical programs, Cancer Institute, Heart Institute, all the employed physicians in those institutes, orthopedics, medicine, surgery. I'm accountable for diversity and outreach for Providence. So I have about 300 docs who actually report up to me. Providence employs about 600. I'm also physician strategy, so I interface with all the aligned physicians in Providence. So I deal with the docs all day. But more importantly, I'm coming from the aspect of where I was as a practicing doc. Based on 30 plus years, what I've learned is, first of all, physicians have to be their patient's advocate. And they have a limited time together, and during that time frame, they want to allocate it to trying to solve their problem or try to figure out what things they need to do or where you need to refer them to get that problem solved, fixed, identified, or dealt with, depending on what the problem is. And that relationship, that very important physician-patient relationship exists in every office, and the time spent is important. And you can question, is the physician motivated of those that report to me or those that we employ to get remuneration or change remuneration predicated on where they refer them? And the answer is absolutely no. We took that out of the equation. We did not want that financial incentive to be in front of that physician. We wanted his or her obligation to care for that patient. And we wanted to reserve that sacred time and use it more appropriately. My inquiry with a lot of docs, both employed and aligned, about this law was they did not like it. They didn't like it because it reflected something on them that they weren't there for. And they didn't want to use their time going through the details of, oh, by the way, although we have no financial incentive to do this, you need to know you have a choice. These patients know they have a choice. And these doctors will send them to any place. If Dr. Anderson wants to have her imaging here and it fits that health plan, that physician is going to be your advocate. That's what they are there for. I don't think this regulation solves what they already think they have and they're entitled to. And that's their choice to go if it's within plans or whatever. I just need to stress that. When talking to them, they're saying, what are they thinking? But we tried. We said, let's try to make this happen. Let's respect the fact the legislature felt this was appropriate. Let's try and do it. Now, we firmly believed in an integrated healthcare network. Integrated healthcare means that physician, if they have this test or see that consultant or this area, it's built in, it gets integrated in their record, so that doc in caring for that patient has all the information at his fingertips. The problem is our electronic medical records don't talk to each other except the ones that were within us. So from an integrated belief in care for these people, it's actually better care. It's better service, it's better understanding, it's lower duplication. It fits the federal government's direction of an accountable care, saying, you guys integrate. It fits the state's obligation and what they did with the CCOs and saying, we're going to give you X amount of money. You guys figure it out and gals figure it out and care for these people with triple aim objectives. It fits the PEB contract. But in spite of that, so there were efforts made. So let me go through what we tried to do to be in compliance with the law, even though I have my physicians kicking and screaming. As Providence shared during the legislative debate on the bill, the aims of the direction of the market, both the public and private, is to move towards coordinated care. We accepted that. Senate Bill 683 passed. We expect the rules would ensure that the notification met the three explicit expectations outlined in the bill. Notice would be timely and meaningful, would be administratively simple, and notice would accommodate the use of an electronic medical record. So throughout the rulemaking process, Providence and others shared our concerns that the rules were either administratively not simple, nor could they accommodate our electronic medical record. I agree with your frustration, Senator. The electronic medical record is a source of frustration for all of us, although a great benefit. We provided written comments to the Rules Committee on public hearings on the rules that we were concerned about. But once the rule was adopted, Providence's compliance, legal, and administrative leadership spent over 100 hours working to try to determine how to implement the rules. Requirements to notify the patient in writing or orally at every referral, except those in the ED and the inpatient, created a major undertaking in changing the workflow. Changes in our EPIC image, our EPIC is not imaging, our EPIC, by the way, is electronic medical record, just to avoid the confusion. Because we needed to ensure that we actually accurately captured each notice to ensure it had an audit trail. So all of a sudden, it's becoming much more complex, much more bureaucratic. And our physicians had to be involved in the process, and that's not what we expected of them, and that's what they yelled back at us about, by the way. There was no place in EPIC to easily capture each notice, which meant that each time a notice was given, the provider would need to document it in the patient's record manually. That's not administratively simple. Actually asking every doctor when the intensity of his day trying to solve the problems that he's dealing with, he and his patients, that's not his high priority or her priority either. The notice requirement was particularly challenging. For example, each time a patient in the primary care needed a lab or imaging, we would need to provide them a notice and then document it in the record, even though the lab was right down the hall. Many times, the referral to the specialist isn't made at the time of the appointment. Instead, it's made sometimes after the lab results come in. So now, you're on the phone saying, hey, I need this, or I need you to do that. Oh, by the way, although I don't get any paid for it, we, Providence, or whomever, have, I guess, an interest someplace in using it other than to keep us connected. So you have to go through that dialogue. And then you have to document it again. And the more we dealt in this, the more complex it got. And we said, you know, we do this for HIPAA. Let's figure out if we can use the HIPAA rules. We'll be tickled pink to do that. But my gosh, to go through this process, you don't want to know the time that's allocated for that and the effort and the struggles we've had. So after spending hours, literally, trying to figure this out and finding more problems with the rules together, we with Legacy Health, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, Josh Balak of PacWest, and others approached policymakers, including Director Hoffman and Susan Colmer, to share our significant concerns, problems, and difficulties in implementing the law. We really appreciate the willingness of Director Hoppen to make those changes and to begin a new RAC process to develop the rules that meet all three. We're willing to be productive partners in the process, but it has to match that simplicity that we're asking about on the front end. Otherwise, I can assure you, I can't get all those docs to do it. So, Jessica?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson. We are more than happy to take any questions that you might have.
Senator Barrett Schrader.
This is a medical records question. So if I'm at, if I go to a Providence doctor, Providence doctor says you need an MRI.
Right.
I said, fine. I like to go to the MRI guy down the road.
Right.
That's where I want to go.
Right.
I go get my MRI. How do those records get into your system?
That's the problem. It doesn't integrate well with Epic because it's not the same electronic medical record. I have to say, I sat on a task force. Remember, I'm an old guy. Mm-hmm. When we tried to develop a health information exchange that would take all these medical records and integrate them into a single one, we had the president of the university, we had all the insurance carriers, we had all the health plans. Nobody in the country was able to do it at the time. We failed miserably after many hours, and we're still failing. It's a huge frustration for us today. If you end up, you scan it in, it is not digitized. So it gets lost in a scanning area where you're going into imaging, you can't see it. Mm-hmm. And part of the value of that integrated healthcare is if you can see it, you're not going to order it again. Or the person who sees it in the emergency room is not going to order it again. Or the consultant is not going to order it again. So it just isn't.
It's a logistical problem.
It's a logistics problem,
yeah.
Completely.
So, like my doctor, who's a good friend of mine, says electronic records are great until you can't find what you need. That's what he tells me.
And believe me, I implemented one at the Oregon Clinic. I implemented it twice at a huge cost. We won't give it up, but it isn't a panacea.
So should we go back to paper records?
There's never. It'll never happen. And it shouldn't. This is better care.
So, Dr. Walta, and I'll get to Senator Prasansky in a second. So, I understand Providence hasn't liked this bill from day one, and I understand that. But what you're arguing then is that meaningful would be me signing my name in that little electronic box at the beginning of my intake. Is that what you're arguing?
I'm saying more. HIPAA, man, you know, we've been living with HIPAA, and HIPAA has
it. So, paint a picture for me. What would it look like?
I think they should sign it on the front end. It should be explained to them. It doesn't have to be the doctor, by the way, who does that. Please don't do that.
There's nothing in here that says the doctor has to do it.
And then put it up in a sign in the waiting room saying, hey, you can, and actually every patient can go where they want to go. There are financial consequences like Dr. Anderson experiences. And part of our obligation is to say, hey, if this is out of pocket, you better talk to the insurance company. But it's interesting, you know, the different carriers have different rules. And if you're a doc and you've got to figure out which rules that insurance carrier has and where they can go, what they're out of pocket. And you want it to be the least expensive for your patient if you can. Honestly, you do.
And you're also arguing that Providence has no encouragement of people referring in network
those
to Providence.
Those 600
providers.
Physicians get paid not one nickel for any lab, not one nickel.
Well, I didn't ask about remuneration. I asked about, is there encouragement in the organization?
Those doctors want them to be, they want to integrate it in the record so it's easily available. So they're going to say, geez, if this one I can see all the time, and I'll see it next year because I won't remember it then, I want it in that record. They will want it there.
Okay. So there is encouragement just for the best reasons, according to you.
Well, the patient.
Chair Shields, I'd like to, if I may, we would not be here today if one of the options to us was to post a sign. If that were the if it were an oral or written or posting of a sign, we would not be here today. We would absolutely support a signage requirement. As a sole requirement, but our reading of the rules in the OAR, the original OAR, which was 333072025 sub 6, required it to be in addition to either of those other things. And for us, that's where there became an issue Nonetheless, today in all of our Providence Medical Group clinics, if you walk into the clinic office, you will see a posting that was developed in accordance with the requirements under the rule that's very specific and in compliance with the original rule before it was rescinded. So we have kept those up, provides that notice to our patients. It also,
could you get us a copy of that?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to do that. In addition, I wanted to give you some information on our referral statistics. Over the last 6 months, we've had 78,252 referrals. Of those, 44,929 were internal. 31,688 were external to the organization. That breaks down on a 57% to 43% breakdown. So today, even within an electronic healthcare record world, almost half of the patients that we see receive referrals external to our organization. And those are with entities that are in networks or out of networks, folks that, as we build networks, we hope to build them with physicians that share our philosophy of coordination. We think that's absolutely critical. Coordination of patient care, that's the direction the private and the public market is heading, and we think that's critical to building solid networks that serve the patients.
But wouldn't you also agree that if as small providers go out of business, that adds leverage to those who are still in the market and has the potential to increase prices?
You know, that's a fair question. From a physician point of view, you know what my focus is? Is where do I send that patient who does the best result or matches the personality of that individual to have the relationship to achieve the best result? So I'm clinical programs. So all the clinical programs, we have criteria for being a member of the program. You don't have to be employed. But you have to be willing to look at your quality. You have to be willing to look at your outcomes. You have to be able to look at your results, your patient satisfaction. If you can't comply with those, you can't even be considered part of the Heart Institute. You can't be considered part of the Cancer Institute. So we have those criteria, and those criteria help determine where our referrals go. But it also has to match. You know, I don't know Dr. Anderson, but if Dr. Anderson came to me and I knew her personality, I'd try to match that personality with the right person or the imaging center that I trusted. And if she said, I want to go here, and it weren't where I thought the quality was, you know, some I'd tell you, because I owe that to you. If you still want to go, okay, that's okay.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You kind of went where I was going to go, and Jessica, thank you. I was going to try to get what the picture would be. Okay. So, from what I'm hearing, what I understand, where the chair and where we intended as the legislature, if you have the written notice that's posted, why wouldn't it be possible, and outside the box here, I don't know how this would actually play out, either annually or sometime on frequent visits or whatever, that some type of notice is actually given to the person? Because I could see where someone may not be reading the walls. And if they have something in their hands, at least we can say we got the information to them. And I understand that every time how frustrating and how ineffective that could be for any type of referral. And the other thing, Mr. Chair, is that, and I know Mr. Powell's in the room, and he may remember when we went through this with auto insurance and such, where they had to give notice that someone could take their car to someone else to have it repaired. I forget what type of notification, if that was just signage or whatever, but I mean, there seems like there's some way to solve this problem where it will be efficient and get the information so individuals can make that informed decision.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, we are absolutely willing to come to the table and think creatively about how to do that, how to make sure that happens. I can't speak to auto insurance. Mr. Powell.
I'm pulling stuff out, you know, set outside the box.
But we are absolutely willing to come to the table and find a way to do this in a way that meets all three bullets, that is meaningful, that is timely, that works administratively simply, and works in a way that is works with an electronic health record. We we are used to HIPAA. That is something that our electronic health record works with. So that's where, from our philosophy, if it's good enough for protected health information, which is absolutely paramount and certainly very real consequences for providers if they don't abide by that, we felt like that would be a good marker for patient choice. If that isn't sufficient, we are willing to think creatively, but we absolutely believe that wherever we go needs to hit all three of those bullets.
Mr. Chair, one other thing is I know that the physician I use, they have gone to some more of the electronic signing, but at the same time, I know that they've taken hard documents that you sign, and then they scan it in. And it seems like in this day and time that that's probably more common or available to offices. So there just seems to me there's a way that you can actually maybe get some type of paper in the person's hand. And I'm not, from my perspective, don't think it has to happen every time they see a doctor to get a referral. But there needs to be some acknowledgement that they have that right. Mm-hmm. And I think as we all probably in our life, you want to get well, you don't know what's going on, and you're not going to be reading everything that's put in front of you, mm-hmm. until maybe you get home and we start absorbing what you just went through.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think actually the chair will use his prerogative to bring up the next panel. I'd like to bring up Bud Herigstad.
For the record, my name's Bud Herigstad. Excuse me. I'm a physical therapist in Newburgh. I have a private practice called Chehalem Physical Therapy. And I have several issues I'd like to talk to. Months ago, the final rule was determined by the Oregon Health Authority after a long process of multiple rules committee meetings in Portland and concessions on both sides of the issue. I was a participating member of the rules committee. One of my original concerns in the process of this legislation and how it finally morphed is that the way things were worded, it's apparent that from patient complaints directly to us, that some physicians interpret the rules as giving choice only if the patient asks for it. The letter of the rule could be followed just by including a statement of patient rights somewhere after the visit, in the after-visit information given to the patient, and if it was just addressed, it could be long after the referral has been made. Our clinic has heard multiple stories of physicians giving what I would call post-referral notification of patient choice for the referred healthcare services. When I asked the patients if they were given any written notification regarding the right to make their own choice of a particular facility for services, none have been able to recall where they have seen a notice, and I've asked quite a few people. A few relate that the physician asked where they prefer the services to be delivered. By far, most relate that they were referred directly within the system's facility for physical therapy. Then, after the patient objected or stated that they preferred another location, the physician would verbally affirm after the fact that the patient could go where they wanted. This is what I term the post-referral notification. One patient stated she was referred directly to a hospital-owned PT service. She related that the physician, and I quote, did tell me when I specifically asked that I could go wherever. Shortly after that, the hospital-owned PT service called me. So I did press the easy button there and went to the hospital-owned PT service. Additionally, the same patient complained that the cost for services was higher than she expected. This is one of our questions we've been talking about, too. Two dates of service for 1.5 hours of physical therapy had charges of $615. She had a high deductible policy and decided that she had to wait on any further treatment because the fees were so high. The charges she shared on the explanation of benefits, which she shared with this person, were actually almost exactly double what our private clinic charges for the same services. We have multiple complaints of patients who had to object to being sent to the hospital-owned PT service. They told the physician they had chosen our clinic for service, and only then were told they could choose where to go. Many have complained that even after they've informed the physician of their choice of a PT facility, they get calls from the competing facility. Numerous patients were called within hours by the hospital physical therapy facility saying, "We're calling to schedule your therapy." Some patients shared that the caller did not even identify themselves until the patient asked who they were. One complained that they were called 3 or 4 times over several days' time. And one was asked, "Well, are you happy where you're going? You could try us." Another patient in May was seen at a hospital-owned medical group and was told she needed an MRI. She was given the hospital MRI phone number and was told to make an appointment. Her own insurance company called her later to inform her that her out-of-pocket expense would be much less if she chose a different facility. The hospital-based MRI charges were quoted at $1,489, whereas the MRI that she went to, about 15 miles away, was $400. The eventual selection of an independent MRI clinic for her amounted to a significant difference in out-of-pocket cost. She had a high deductible policy also. In all of these circumstances, the patient is being referred first to the hospital-owned facility for services. When a patient objects, yes, the physician usually informs that the patient has a right to choose. But how many others are actually being informed of their rights if they do not initially object? One more example. I have two copies of physical therapist contact information, which is commonly given out by physician offices. This first one is from an independent physician in our community, and it includes PT clinics from all the neighboring towns in our area. It's hospital-owned services, it's private clinics, and all are given equal standing, and the contact information is included. Can't contrast that with this list that was given out several months ago to another patient who gave it to us. There are approximately 30-some clinics on this list. So the patient is under the impression that this is a whole list of possibilities or their possibilities in their area. This is outside the metro area, and these are metro PT clinics. Every one of them on this list, except two, are directly owned by a hospital. And the two that are not, we believe, are joint ventures. I don't know for sure, but all but two are owned by the hospital, and none are private clinics. I was very disappointed to see that the final rule that was implemented months ago was again changed due to objections from certain physicians that contacted the Oregon Health Authority. I was part of the rulemaking process and attended all of those meetings. Yet the decision to strike out large portions of the final rule was made without further participation or input in the matter from the other involved parties. And I would add that comments have been made, you know, we should be following federal rules. We should look for simpler examples. I've since found a sample. This is obtained from a hospital discharge planner in Eastern Oregon, who I know. And I told her that somewhere I had heard that home health referrals from a hospital have to be, the patient has to be given the choices of who would provide the home health service. It turns out there is a very small section of Section 1861 of the Social Security Act. And this very concise place here is what makes for fair referrals in home health. The discharge plan shall not specify or otherwise limit the qualified provider which may provide post-hospital home health services, and to identify in a form and manner specified any entity to whom the individual is referred in which the hospital has a disclosable financial interest, et cetera, et cetera. It can be done very simply. And I'm hoping that I do agree we may have to go back to the drawing board in some respects on this, because it's not working well for us. And it should not be any more difficult than a prescription for a pain medication. The physician wouldn't dare tell you you have to go to a certain place for your pain prescription. All he does is say, where do you want it called in? And that's all I would like for physicians to do to make it fair for all concerned and to bring patient choice back into the picture.
Any questions? And a lot of the impetus for this bill was based on your experience in Newburgh as an independent physical therapist, correct?
I helped kickstart it, but there were multiple clinics. It was a statewide problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And multiple hospital problem is not just one agency.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Harrington? Harrigstad. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Can we bring up Danielle Sobel from OMA, please?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Danielle Sobel, and I am the Associate Director of Health Policy for the Oregon Medical Association. We'd like to thank you today for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the OMA and our members and what it meant for them to go through the rules process and then the actual implementation of these particular rules. As a member of the Rules Advisory Committee, we certainly advocated, like many others on the committee, and I think all of us were on the same page around the intent of the legislation being that it was timely, meaningful, and administratively simple. And that does mean administratively simple for both the patient and for our members and our providers. As we went through the Rules Advisory Committee process, we did reach out to our members to find out what that would mean and what that would look like. And what we heard over and over was that when a patient has choice in their referral, they are more likely to complete that referral. So again, our members are making every effort to ensure that they're helping that patient get to where they need to go within the parameters of their insurance, because we are bound, unfortunately, by that insurance, to get that referral taken care of.
Can I ask you a quick question about that? Did you reach out to small clinics, and can you give me some examples of ones that you reached out to?
Chair Shields, we actually heard from emails. So we sent emails about the particular rules that were being considered. And I would need to go back to my notes, and I'm happy to do that to find out who responded and who actually came back. We received an overwhelming response from our membership on the actual final rules when they were implemented. But it was all of a state. I mean, I can tell you that I answered those emails. We answered the phone calls. So I'd be happy to provide you with that at a later date.
Please get it to Chana, the professional staff.
Absolutely.
And so you emailed all your members, said, what do you think about this?
We did a mass email, yeah. And actually, we did multiple emails over the course of both the rules and then as the rule, or the final rules that were released in both June, July, and then the August final rules. So our members actually got a little bit bombarded with all of the changes going on, but we certainly got a really good response from our membership. And as we went through that rules committee, we certainly supported and continue to support a standardized patient notification process that complements the existing practices, because again, many of our members already have processes in place. They have dedicated staff in place to help those patients figure out where to go, who to go to, and where to get that care. And again, we don't want to create repetitive or administratively burdensome processes when they have processes in place. As many have mentioned before, and I won't harp on that too much, the RAC process was complicated by a lack of consensus. It was very difficult to get at many of those key provisions, including the written notification. I mean, I think one of the biggest areas of contention was, what does that written notification look like? How do we do the written notification? When? All of those different pieces. So when those rules were finally released, we were a little bit surprised that it was an and. So that it does require written notification at the time of registration. It required notification when they were doing the referral, and then that wall posting as well. So that was particularly burdensome. Those are the original rules that came out. And that multiple process of notification created not only the burden for our providers, but also for the patient, because that patient could be notified three times in one day or in that course of that visit that, by the way, you have choice in where you get your referral, which actually can cause confusion for patients when you look at that, of they're in a vulnerable place, you know, they may or may not be able to make that choice. And so for our providers, it created lots of questions about, you know, should I follow my doctor's recommendation? Should I seek out care elsewhere? What does that look like for me now that I've been notified of this choice? It also takes away from patient care for our providers in terms of, as mentioned previously, the documentation that they have to do to comply with legislation. And again, that means documenting in the EHR or a form being given to the patient when they do that oral notification. The other piece that was a little bit frustrating as we worked through with our members, and we did actually provide model language similar to a few others into Providence for our members, was that the different notifications actually had different requirements. So for example, the wall posting actually required that the clinic have a staff member or a designated person on staff to whom the patient could refer or ask for to get more information about the particular bill. And again, that goes beyond the scope of the bill, the legislation, in terms of making this administratively simple and easy for patients to understand their choice. And then just in terms of the implementation, as I mentioned, we did educate and re-educate our members up to three and four times, and again, done via email. And then at our educational offerings, we offer CME for our providers, so making sure they knew about the rules, that these rules were in effect, and that they needed to notify their patients. I think it was a little bit difficult for them to understand, what do I need to do? I am still, in fact, two and a half months after the initial release, still getting questions about, you know, do I need to do that, or what am I doing? And at this point, obviously, it's a simple either written or oral notification. There's no longer a wall posting that's required, but has made it very, very complicated for our members to comply, and they do want to comply with legislation, given, you know, that they have reasonable knowledge of what they need to comply with. And then the last piece, similar to what you've heard previously, we would certainly support any kind of standardized form that could be used to notify patients at the time that they register, or even annually. And I do know that many of our members annually require patients to sign the HIPAA notification, because, again, that has changed in recent years. I've had to sign that when I go in for annual visits.
And you read it all completely and thoroughly, I assume.
I actually have, but not many.
So how would that be meaningful, then?
I think it's meaningful in terms of the patient would then have it in front of them. Most clinics in the beginning, and bear in mind that back when HIPAA was new, you would be handed the HIPAA form and said, you know, go ahead and read it, or here's a copy. We can provide you with a copy to take home. I think nowadays we don't see that as much, because HIPAA has been in effect for so long, we assume, and maybe not correctly, that patients do know about HIPAA. But in this case, if it was a simple form, and even a one-page form that they could give and they ensured was given to the patient would have that in front of them to know, I can go anywhere for my referral. And again, that's referrals for, you know, labs, procedures, and any kind of specialist. So, we believe that it would be meaningful. It is, you know, same as the federal law. It does put us more in compliance with what's required from the federal side for HIPAA. It would be given to the patient. And I think a tandem piece to that would then be the wall posting as a reminder. I mean, the flip side, too, would, depending on the size of the clinic, would be to ask that wall posting be posted either in, you know, clinic lobbies and possibly in exam rooms. And I got that question quite a bit from our members as well, of, is it every room? Is it, you know, in the lobby? Where do we put this?
But the OMA also fought just oral notification, communicating to the patient, correct?
Chair Shields, and members of the committee, we didn't fight it so much as the way that it was originally written in the rules that were being looked at during the advisory committee. It actually would have required a written notification as well. So the wording around it was you could give oral notification, but then they also had to give additional information about where to get more information. And so for a clinic, that wouldn't mean having your provider know all of that or give that again in a very truncated kind of visit. It means they would have to give it on the phone to say, you know, we're referring you to so-and-so, or you can go wherever you would like, and we'll be putting in the mail more information about the referral. So for us, that actually negated the oral notification.
So you'd be okay with just straight oral notification that was documented somehow?
And documented in the EHR. or somewhere in the chart. And we do recommend that still as our providers are going through this for compliance.
Okay. All right. Any more testimony?
I think I hit all of it. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions?
The thing about oral notification, it always scares me because it comes to he said, she said, and I understand that if the doctor is actually writing in the notes, but you know, it's still one of those things that in the moment, the patient may not hear what's being said because their mind is thinking, I've got what? I need to do what? So that's it just, you know, maybe it's the attorney part of me. It just seems like something writing that you get to somebody.
Well, you bring up a good point. So what is the, Shannon, this question is for you. What recourse does the person have? Let's say, the law says they need to inform a choice that maybe the patient disputes that.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, Section 2 says a health practitioner who fails to comply with ORS 441.098, the subject here, shall be subject to disciplinary action by the Oregon Health Licensing Agency or by the appropriate health professional regulatory board. The Oregon Health Licensing Agency or the appropriate health professional regulatory board may investigate a claim under this law and the authority granted under ORS 676.165.
Okay.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, they may also take disciplinary action under Section 2 of this 2013 Act. The agency or board may also impose a civil penalty of not more than $1,000 on a health practitioner for violations.
Okay. So basically they go to the board and complain. And then the board can choose to do something about it or not, and they've got very big leeway on what they can do. Is that correct?
Chair Shields, that was our understanding okay. as well.
All right. So no UTPA violation, no Class C felony. All right, just go to the board. All right, good. Any other questions? All right, and batting cleanup then, if we could please bring up Diana Godwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Diana Godwin. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. I represent 165 independent practice physical therapy clinics throughout the state of Oregon. They are all, as I said, they're owned by physical therapists. I have asked the clerk to distribute to you some testimony I've brought today, and I'm not going to go through it extensively, except to tell you that last week I asked my clinics throughout the state to let me know what their experience had been during the last 6 months since this bill has been enacted and since we went through a lengthy and, I agree, contentious and difficult rulemaking process, and a final rule did come out in early June, and I informed all of my clinics about the provisions of that rule. But I asked them, what are you seeing out there? Are you seeing any change in the problems we had seen prior to this bill? And unfortunately, not really. They're still saying that they're finding probably one of the most challenging problems is that when a patient sees a physician who is employed by a hospital system, that the referrals almost automatically go to an outpatient clinic owned by the hospital, and that in fact the patients are automatically referred, and I would echo some earlier testimony that Bud made, that the patient gets called immediately by that clinic. In fact, I did get some feedback from a clinic in the local Portland area. It said, I happen to have three family members who work for Adventist who will, quote, get in trouble, close quote, if they refer to a clinic that is not an Adventist clinic. My spouse is an Adventist patient and was fast-tracked for physical therapy at an Adventist clinic as well. The hospital never advised my spouse of the right to choose where to receive physical therapy. They handed my spouse a referral, and the Adventist-owned physical therapy clinic started calling my spouse within minutes of him leaving the doctor's office. That's one of the concerns that we've got. And I actually had a very small one-person clinic down in the Eugene area that has been severely hurt by this practice. They're not by a hospital, but by a physician-owned physical therapy clinic, a local urgent care clinic, and the doctors there refer all the private pay, workers' compensation, and motor vehicle accident patients to their own physical therapy clinic. Patients who previously seen me and who wanted to come to me for their new course of care have told me that the physicians at the local clinic did not tell them they had a choice and would not give them a referral to my clinic. But these same physicians do refer the low-paying Medicaid patients to me. So I'm not sure how grateful she was. And down in Southern Oregon, this is happening on the coast. I got comments from the Mid-Coast, the Southern Coast, Southern Oregon, Eastern Oregon, Portland area, Mid-Valley. It's all the same, very concerned that patients who fight to come to their physical therapist that they'd gone to before, but then they're referred elsewhere, they all say, I was referred to the hospital. I had to really argue about the fact that I wanted to go to my local physical therapist. I did get some information from a clinic who has been seeing a Medicare patient for her neck for about the previous 6 weeks. The patient's doing great, but she has a problem with her hip and recently saw her MD, her MD at OHSU. And again, this is not Providence. We're not ganging up on Providence. We're talking larger hospital systems. She saw her MD at OHSU, who proceeded to send her to their physical therapist without telling her she could go anywhere she prefers. This, as you can imagine, is frustrating for obvious reasons. The patient has already received one treatment and is scheduled for a second tomorrow, meaning today, at OHSU. I've asked the patient to choose one therapy provider and discharge the other. In other words, she said, pick between the two of us because it's not in your interest, patient, to pay two copays, have to go to two different places, have two separate appointments, and two billings to Medicare when she could simply have one. So even though she may lose that patient, she understood what's in the patient's interest. And I do want to talk about the rulemaking and some concern I've got about this temporary rule. I did participate in all of it. And I did also want to talk a little bit about Dr. Walta's point about the burden to the physician who wants to spend their time really dealing with the medical problems of the patient. I totally get that. That's what we all want. But my concern is that this temporary rule eliminated the language that allowed the practitioner's designee to provide the notice. And I thought, well, wait a minute. They had deleted all of subsection 3 of OAR 333-072-0215, and it starts out, a health practitioner or the practitioner's designee shall provide notice of patient choice. They could have just put a period there, left that sentence in, put a period there, and deleted the rest at least. But now, at the very beginning of the rules, there's some point about the purpose of these rules is to establish notice requirements, but there's no other statement in here in the rules that says, guess what, you got to provide some notice. They could have left that sentence in, put that period after that. And then my concern is they did leave in what was subsection 5 and is now subsection 3 of that rule, and they said the written or oral notice shall include language that informs the patient about, you know, their choice. But the problem with that is that in that there is no statement whatsoever about timeliness or when it should be given at all, which flies in the face of the requirement of the statute, which says the notice shall be designed to ensure that the information is conveyed in a timely manner. So now we have a temporary rule out there for the next 6 months. This doesn't say anything about when this notice is to be given. They could even have just inserted the word timely and let people at least... I know that that's an ambiguous word, and it's in the eyes, like pornography, in the eyes of the beholder, what's timely. But at least they could have used the word timely to alert people that you do have to do it in a reasonably timely manner. But that was very disappointing, the way in which this temporary rule was done. I will continue to work with my physical therapist. I have advised my physical therapist not to complain about doctors, but in fact, call them up. Send them a note saying, Mrs. Smith, Mr. Jones has come to my clinic, but they tell me that they had some difficulty in, saying they really wanted to come back to me. I've been their provider before. I hope, that you'll respect the new challenge, the new law on making sure patients have some choice, even though the patient does have to look to their insurance to see what's covered. We have some huge challenges out there in healthcare. I just spent the whole weekend in Seattle with the American Physical Therapy Association going over what the huge challenges are out there nationally and on the state level. Things like any qualified and willing provider to be able to provide services. We're seeing narrower and narrower and narrower networks out-of-networks, and that is one of the problems, that sometimes patients don't even have an out-of-network benefit, even at 50%. And that also affects patient choice, it affects costs in the healthcare system, and it's just frustrating. And I know we're in a tremendously challenging time of transition. We're moving to electronic medical records. We all get the need to coordinate care and avoid duplication. And I don't have any great answers for it, but I'm just here to offer some perspective and answer questions if I can.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Bertschinger.
A question.
Oh, sure.
I'll just give you a little scenario. So say I'm a physician. I'm in partners in a clinic with multiple physicians. I have a patient. I say, you need physical therapy on whatever. And we have a physical therapy unit in this clinic, which is very good. I'm telling my patient this.
Cool.
However, there are other ones out there, and it's at your discretion. Would that be an acceptable?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. That's what you just tell the patient. Yes, you have choices. We have a PT in here, which, you know, discloses to them that they've got a financial interest because we employ our own physical therapist, and that's fine. In fact, one of our physical therapists here in Salem gave me some testimony that, it's a physician-owned physical therapy clinic or practice, and they do work, they do refer back and forth to each other. Have a good working relationship. And that's what I encourage my physical therapists to do, is to make sure they always have good working relationships, you know, with their physicians. But some, when the physicians' practices are bought up by big hospitals and they come in and become employees of the hospital, there is pressure to refer to the hospital-based clinics. And sometimes, in fact, there's some testimony in here about one physician who specifically doesn't use the hospital EMR system to refer patients because it's tracked, and she wants the patient to go to the local private practice clinic because there's some specialty skills there that she wanted the patient to get. So it's happening out there.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Diana, for reminding us why we got here in the first place. We were here to address a challenge in the marketplace and some unfairness. So I think we'll go ahead and we'll close the that portion of, well, I don't need to gavel up. Close that portion of the hearing, thankfully, and move on to the next one. Commissioner Kelly, you've been very kind in patient and waiting, and David Rosenfeld from Osberg, if you could come up as well.
Well, thank you, Chair Shields. And I don't know if you have a preference as to which of us goes first.
How about you?
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you. Well, Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Calley. I'm the insurance commissioner with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'm here today to give you a recap on the 2015 rate review process that concluded here a little over a month ago. And some of it might be a bit of a refresher in terms of what our process is and how it looks, and then I want to give you some highlights of the findings that we had and some of the things that we're looking at as we cast an eye toward the next rate review process and what improvements we might need to be making. So our process is a pretty intensive process. We conduct it in about 60 days, and it is transparent, and we really encourage the public to be involved. And this year, it started in the very beginning of June. We received 41 filings from more than a dozen insurance companies, and so I think that's really important to highlight the competitive market that we enjoy here in the individual and small group space. 41 filings is the most that we've had to look at one time, and the reason that there were so many is that we have the plans that comply with the ACA, but we also have transitional plans that were allowed to continue for a limited period of time, and also grandfathered plans that were in effect at the time that the ACA was passed. So it made for a lot of work, but it also meant that we could look at the individual and the small group markets really in totality at the same time. We went through this process through the end of July, and we released our decisions in the beginning of August. And generally speaking, you can really see the impact of competition on the final rates. Carriers who had higher rates in 2014 came in with proposals that were significantly lower than what they had gone out with in 2015. A few carriers who had some of the lower rates in 2015 requested some rate increases in 2015. And when you look at how our decisions lined up with the proposals from these carriers, I'd say we took a very consistent view toward the industry in terms of the adjustments that we made, but we always kept our focus on what's in the best interest of the public, and that really is a very difficult balance to strike. And so we want to make sure that rates are adequate and they're reasonable so that they make sense for the benefits being provided. They're not too high, but they're also not too low. And I think it's really important to focus on that not too high, not too low. It's not an exact science. It's a projection of what the future claims will be. And we're still in a world where we don't have claims data that shows us a full year post-reform. So insurance companies and our reviewing actuaries are having to make estimates of what they think the impact will be. And so what this led to is that we, on some of the rates that were proposed on the lower end, we actually approved rates that were slightly higher, and we thought that was it was appropriate. We wanted to make sure that insurance companies are charging rates that are sustainable, aren't going to drive the need for large rate increases next year, and aren't going to put the companies in a position of having financial difficulty, and that ultimately would be bad for consumers. On the flip side, we had a number of carriers whose rate proposals we believed to be too high, and we adjusted those downward. So you have kind of a mix, but generally speaking, I think what you see is a tighter range of rates, particularly in the individual market, than we saw in 2014, and on average slightly less than what the rate levels were in 2014. And the small group market, I won't probably spend as much time talking about that just because it wasn't the dynamics are not as dramatically different in the small group market as they have been in the past. We did see that rates increased slightly over the prior year, but the changes in the benefit designs, the impact of guaranteed issue of not having medical underwriting really isn't an issue for small group because they already had that before the reform. So much less volatility in that market. One of the key things that we did see as an issue for us this time around is that if a carrier doesn't agree with our finding, there's really a very limited ability to have a discussion about that disagreement. And right now, our current rate review law points back to the administrative procedures and kind of takes things to the Office of Administrative Hearings and outside of the department. And so one of the things that we're going to be looking at, we've actually begun already, but we're talking with stakeholders, including the carriers and Osberg as well, and other stakeholders who are interested in the process to get their feedback about how we can make that more effective. Is that avenue for recourse necessary? If so, what should it look like? Should it look different than it does today? And so I think that's something that just is important for you all to be aware of, and I certainly would welcome your feedback and thoughts as well about how we can make sure that process is really still in the best interest of consumers but allows for the full vetting of the concerns that we might find with filings and does so in the public view. So I think that's really all I have for the prepared comments. I did want to just make a quick reference to the handout that was shared with you. It's just an example of some of the consumer decision tools that we make available. And so I gave you the Salem area just as an example. But we have all of these posted for each of the seven geographic rating areas in the state. We show it for age 21, age 40, and age 60, just to give you an idea of what the range of rates will be. And we use the standard plans since every carrier in the state is required to offer these plans in all geographic areas that they do business. So it gives you a point of comparison. We also have decision summaries on the web that explain why we made the decisions that we did for each of the filings. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Commissioner Cullen, one thing that I was somewhat concerned about is that we might be setting some precedent where one insurance company was allowed to kind of go much lower than the others in the first time around, mm-hmm. and then ask for a very significant increase the second time around. And Can you explain, and that was the MoDA decision, can you explain to me some of the rationale? I didn't really have a chance to read and dive into it, but I, if I was in the other carrier's shoes, I'd be scratching my head saying, okay, so they've captured, you know, 50% of the market, and now they're going to increase their rates and probably, I mean, it's helpful that pre-existing conditions allow people to bounce, but I think many people will just stay where they are because it's comfortable. So can you comment on that?
Sure. Chair Shields, members of the committee, I think that's actually one of the important things that we were looking at this time around. I think it's a combination of looking at, are the rates and the requested changes reasonable, and what are the market dynamics that are being set up by the proposed rates, and then ultimately our decisions, because I think we want to be careful that in approving the rates that we're not really we're not setting the competitive position of the carriers, but that we're being consistent in applying our decisions about the impact of various factors in the market. So in the particular case of the MoDA filing, I believe they requested a 12.5% rate increase, and we approved something a bit less, closer to 10%. And I know that, you know, that's still a double-digit rate increase, and that it's not nothing to consumers, and I know that that's really important. But I think there are a couple things to keep in mind with that filing in particular. If you look at the assumptions that the carrier made, there weren't wild departures from the prior filing in terms of what's the impact of eliminating medical underwriting and some of these other factors that would drive rate changes year to year. But there's medical trend, which is just the increase in the cost of medical care from year to year that was included, and that is across the board for all of the filings. And there's also with the reinsurance programs that are part of the stabilization of rates in the individual market for the first couple of years, that program actually has less impact in the second year than it did in the first year. So you would see that just by using by reflecting the reduced impact of reinsurance and including medical trend, that if everything else is held equal, you'd see an increase in rates to reflect those two changes. So, you know, in that rate request, there weren't other large assumptions that drove the rates higher. What you saw, by contrast, with other carriers, particularly those that took significant rate decreases, is that their filings in 2014 took a more conservative view of some of the impacts of the ACA. And I think, as I mentioned before, there's not a precise right answer. These are projections, and so there are ranges of reasonable projections, and some carriers made decisions to be a bit more aggressive within a reasonable range this year. But, you know, we share your concern about significant changes in market position year over year that might negatively affect consumers. You know, I think as we start to see more data come through rather than relying on significant projections, you know, I think we expect to see some stabilization in the market over time, and so I think that will be helpful. But it's still, I think, a difficult process for both carriers and for us as the reviewers and the regulators to find out what exactly the right answer is going to be. But next year we'll start to get a little bit more data as to what's actually happened post-reform.
Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Remind me again how the medical inflation rate is determined, and what is it for this past year? Because it always seems that there's double-digit inflation rates increase in premiums.
Right. And I was looking to see if I brought my metrics here about Chair Shields, members of the committee. We did approve kind of a tight range of trend for 2015, and there were a couple of carriers that had proposed something slightly higher than what we thought was reasonable. But if I recall correctly, and I can confirm, we thought a range between 4.5% and 7% was considered to be a reasonable forecast of future trend. And, you know, just like other assumptions, there's not necessarily one right answer. This is a projection of what future costs will increase by. So there's not always one right answer. There also are reasons why that might vary from carrier to carrier. Some carriers have more control over their contracted medical costs by virtue of the system that they operate within. Some have some narrower networks or a variety of different networks that allow them to control costs better than others. And so there is variation across the carriers. What we look for is that we look at their historical historical data to look at year over year how their costs have increased, and then we also rely on information that they provide to us about how their contracted reimbursement rates are changing from one year to the next. I think one thing that is currently missing but is something that we're working on is to have access to broader data that our actuaries can mine and evaluate to better understand really from a statewide perspective what has been the real trend in the past and what do we think that looks like going forward. So one of the things that we're working on with the Oregon Health Authority is to better use APAC as something that as a tool that our actuaries can use in doing some independent analysis. So it's something that we're in the process of looking at right now about how we can best get access to that and use that as another diagnostic tool.
Remember the LPRL claims database?
I'm sorry.
Just follow
not
up.
Not a political act.
No. Well, it's frustrating in a sense for me because I don't know the complexities of the rate review process, but the medical inflation rate is between what you said four to seven, yet you're still approving rates at 10% increase. So.
Well, Chair Shields, if I may, so Senator Amanis-Anderson, I think in the particular case where we approve some larger increases, it's not just trend that's driving it. So the reinsurance program, there's a federal reinsurance program and also a state reinsurance program that in the first 3 years of reform are designed to stabilize the rates for the individual market. And so there's an assessment that's used to fund that, assistance to pay for claims above a certain level in the individual market, and it was designed in such a way that it had the most impact in 2014. It steps down in 2015 and again in 2016. So some of what you're seeing on, for example, that MOTA rate change is the decreasing impact of reinsurance. That means that rates increase by more than just trend.
And lastly, we are fortunate that in Oregon you can consider surplus in these filings. Can you tell me how surplus was considered in the MOTA case? Do you happen to recall?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, I don't have exactly with me how we factored that in, but I think one of the things that is important is as we looked across the market in terms of whether the rates were reasonable, we looked at whether there was risk that they would have to come back for a significant rate increase in the future and understand, how our rate decision today would affect potential rate requests in the future. That's always part of our consideration. But, we also looked at financial results for all of the carriers in the first couple quarters of 2014. And, many, many carriers, I believe, including MOTA, sustained some losses in the first quarter. And we consider that as well. I mean, I think it's important to understand that we need a viable market and that all of these carriers, some of them are better capitalized than others for sure, but that all of these carriers have an opportunity to continue to be going concerns and provide good choice for consumers in our market.
Senator Mouse,
yeah, but you'd think that if you have over 70%, and I think that's what MOTA had, over 70% of the market share, that that they'd still come out on top with the risk pool that they have, with so much of the rock, with so many taking MOTA, you'd think that the risk was spread over, so they'd have, yes, some that are costing more and others that, of course, don't. But that isn't taken into account, that they had over 70% of the market share and the cost still, they still had more costs.
So, Chair Shields, members of the committee, Senator Amanis-Anderson. So, the way that we look at rate review is that every carrier has to price assuming that they're going to insure the market average risk. So, there are a couple of programs that actually redistribute funds across the market within a state to ensure that a carrier who attracts better than average risk isn't actually performing better just because of who they're attracting versus someone who's attracting worse than average risk. So, MOTA in this perspective. perspective, if they're attracting a larger portion of the market, they're probably getting a fairly good representation of a market average risk, but we don't know for sure that that will be the case. Risk adjustment, which is the program that kind of redistributes funds across the market, that calculation doesn't occur until actually sometime in the middle of 2015. So we'll have a better sense there for how their book compares to the market average. I mean, I think certainly it gives them a larger pool to spread risk across. But I think the other piece of this goes back to every carrier is making a judgment about what they expect future claim costs to be. And I think it's still an unknown whether all of the projections will pan out to be close to what they actually pay in claims. So I think there are a number of factors at play that determine whether a carrier's book of business becomes profitable or not, and how that plays into their market position. But it is something that, you know, we are monitoring. We monitor all of our carriers in terms of their solvency and in terms of their rate adequacy. And, you know, certainly as we start to see more claims data come in, it'll be better information for us to ensure that our decisions are not kind of rewarding, you know, overshooting or undershooting.
Devin, welcome to the committee.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, I'm Dave Rosenfeld. I'm the executive director of Osberg, the Consumer Group, and Osberg Foundation, which does research and policy analysis for the public interest. For a number of years now, we have, in contract with DCBS, the insurance division, done in-depth analysis on significant rate filings as part of Oregon's rate review process. We'll take a look at some of the larger rate hikes that are being proposed. We'll do an analysis. We'll put that in the form of written public comments to the insurance division. And then we will also do our part to just help to increase public awareness and participation in Oregon's rate review process. This year, in this round, we took a look at four of the filings, MOTA, HealthNet, Pacific Source, and United Healthcare. We obviously would love to look at more. We chose those because those are among the largest insurers in the market, and we're proposing among the bigger increases. And so we thought of all the ones that we could give a second opinion to the division on, those would be the ones that would be the best ones to capture. It's customary for us in the last couple of years, in addition to doing all of what I've described, to do a postmortem, a written postmortem on the process. No, that's probably a bad choice of words, but you know what I mean. We submitted that last week. We released that to the public, and that was submitted here to you all as part of the testimony. I won't go into all of it, but I'll give you just five top lines from the process this time around. First off, this round of rate filings, the insurance division cut about $24 million in unnecessary costs from insurance premiums going into next year. If you tally up what the insurance division has done since 2010, that adds up to about $179 million in unnecessary costs that have been taken out of insurance premiums for consumers. There have been some news reports that the overall result of that is that premiums are still going to go up for most people in the individual and small group market. And I want to just be clear that that is not the inaccurate characterization of the actual situation. It is true, obviously, MOTA having the biggest market share and of the individual market and having been approved for a 10% and some rate hike, if everyone stays on the MOTA plan, that would be true. However, it is important for consumers to know that this is, as has been stated, a competitive marketplace. It is easier than ever before, even with all of our challenges with the insurance marketplace and reform, it's easier than ever before to shop around, do comparison shopping, look at insurers apples to apples, and to switch insurers. And so we think that it is important that outside of the rate review process that consumers understand that. And so if they're on, if price is an important thing to a consumer and their insurer happens to be going up, in fact, you could look around at many other plans and there are rates that are going down and that would be good for consumers. So a little bit of context on that, number one. Number two is the issue with Pacific Source and what that says about the market. As you may know, Pacific Source originally came in and proposed almost a 16% rate hike. Shortly after all of the insurers filed, Pacific Source found that said that they had made an error in their filing and then walked back their rate to around 10.5% or so. And this is before any of the rate review process really began. And you'll recall that last year a similar thing happened with Providence. And you could say a number of things about that, but one thing that seems pretty clear to us is that it's reasonable to think that just the sheer openness and transparency of Oregon's rate review process creates the kind of climate where these sorts of market corrections happen even before a regulator takes their red pen out. And that's good. That's the kind of thing that we want, is to create a market environment where when these kinds of mistakes are made, an insurer will come on back and go, yo, we made a mistake, we want to fix that, and that's good for consumers. And so that's just a second top line observation of just how the marketplace is working. Third is the issue of uncompensated care. I'm going to assume that we know what that term means, and I'll go back and explain it. But we found that none of the insurers, although all throughout the year we have been getting more and more data that makes it clear that, thankfully, rates of uncompensated care are going down as more and more people are getting insured. None of the filings initially took that into account in passing those savings on to customers. So there was some digging and back and forth that went on. And among the actions that the insurance division took, one was to do a fairly across the board, with some nuances, but a fairly across the board cut among all carriers to reflect that fact and pass those savings back to consumers, roughly about 2%. And that's reflected in all of the rates that we see. And that's a good thing. And that's, you know, we should be very happy about that.
David, can I ask you a quick question about that? So since hospitals are kind of the bulk of the healthcare costs, unless the hospitals are cutting their costs based on the fact that they now are getting compensated care versus uncompensated care, why would the insurance companies see the benefit of that if the hospitals are not passing that along?
Yeah.
And something tells me they wouldn't willingly do that unless the leverage required it.
Right. Chair Shields, members of the committee, I think I'll give a quick remark and then perhaps defer to Commissioner Kelly, who might be able to explain also more of the rationale. It's a good point, because in the back and forth that we had with some of the carriers, there was a variety of responses that we got as to, hey, why are you not passing this on to consumers? It's obvious that's happening. One of the responses, truth be told, was that, well, hey, we tried to bring this up with some of our providers and they weren't fighting. And
that's interesting. No, thanks.
And then others were just that wasn't the only response we got. Another response that we got, at least in one instance, was, well, we don't really actually think that this is a dynamic that's happening, which feels somewhat Monty Python-esque because the data was very clear that it was happening. So what we would say in response to your question is that regardless of whether or not any individual insurer had succeeded this time around in negotiating their contracts to reflect the reduction in uncompensated care, this action sends a really, really strong signal to the marketplace that this has got to happen. We've got to pass on these savings to consumers. We've got to quantify it. It's got to go somewhere. And that creates some additional leverage, frankly, for the carriers to be able to go in and get the job done.
Okay. Chair Shields, some members of the committee, I don't have a ton to add to that because I think Dave explained it very eloquently. But I think one of the other pieces, though, is if you think about the fact that if there's less uncompensated care, that means that people are getting access to coverage either through expansion of Medicaid or through commercial health plans. And so if rates are not being adjusted to reflect that more people are actually paying for coverage and getting that coverage, then there'd be some overcorrection. And I think, we saw the variety, obviously, that Dave saw in terms of the responses. But I think ultimately we felt that the data was there and that there were a couple of carriers that did demonstrate that they reflected some of that in there. And those we didn't make adjustments for. But for the rest, we really felt that it was an important point and an important thing to make sure that we passed back to consumers.
Okay. Senator Moss Anderson.
I'll be very interested, and you probably will track this now that LifeWise has come in as the lowest provider, if everyone that was MOTA transfers to LifeWise. I mean, that shows you that cost has a huge factor in, but we'll see. Mm-hmm. Next, I guess open enrollment is
November 15th. It begins, yes.
And it ends
February 15th.
Yeah, so next. Give us a report in March.
Yeah. I mean, I just
happy to do so.
I just think it's so critical, though, that we also notice that networks are narrowing, and while you, in theory, you do have choice based on the pre-existing condition not being there anymore, but still there, if your physician is not covered by this second plan, you don't really have a choice except to go to this other plan and then switch providers. So to jump is still a little sticky. Good thing is it's not as sticky as it used to be, but it's still there.
Yeah, Chair Shields, members of this committee, that's absolutely right, and another thing that needs to get looked at.
Yeah.
I'll say two more things about all of this. Some of the proposals we saw, this is in regards to medical trend. We just had a discussion about it, so not to reiterate that, but just to acknowledge that in one instance, United Healthcare came in and had originally projected a little bit over an 8.1% increase in medical costs in their trend. And as Commissioner Kelly said, they were looking at a spread of between 4.5% and 7%. And in that instance, United's rate was pared back to get there. And we would concur that there could be, I believe, if I'm hearing what you were saying correctly, that we could do more to try to standardize and also make more transparent exactly what is the methodology that goes into medical trend. As an example, we had a back and forth with HealthNet in the course of the process, and one of the question was, they said 7% was what their number was, so right on the margin of what was acceptable by the division. And the answer was, well, that's proprietary information. Now, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but the point is that if we're really going to do our job right in this process, then either the methodologies have to be transparent, or if that's not the case, then at least there has to be some standardization in how we arrive at these numbers if we're going to be able to compare apples to apples. So that's just that point, but it should be acknowledged on the United instance. Finally, we can get medical trend perfect, and it really doesn't change the elephant in the room that we all know, which is that healthcare costs too much. There's an enormous amount of waste in the healthcare system, and that insurance is really just one part of it, and that when you take a look, it's all of the market actors that have some kind of role in containing costs while boosting the quality of care. That's insurance, but it's also hospitals, medical device manufacturers, prescription drug companies, consumers, et cetera, et cetera. And in that regard, to the extent that the insurance market does play a role in containing costs and boosting quality. One new feature of the rate review process this year, to the insurance division's credit, was that there were some additional metrics that were required to be reported that asked insurers for very hard data on utilization, cost, and quality on a set of different metrics, which no need to get into them right here. And the intent is this year to establish a baseline for what are different insurers doing in a very detailed way, and then use that to compare as we go year to year, which insurers are doing better to bend their cost curve, as it were, and how are they doing apples to apples. And our hope is that eventually 2, 3, 4 years, whenever, that starts to become starts to get reflected in the rate decisions. This was the first year that it was done. I think I could say, the best thing I could say is that one, really good that information was there, is very interesting to look at. It raised more questions than it gave answers, which is kind of what we expected because it's the first year we're doing it. And so, for example, many large insurers, if you took a look at it, one conclusion you might reach is, hey, some of these biggest insurers have really higher than average emergency room utilization and prices. So you'd go, that's a problem. But because that's the only information you got, there could be any one of a number of explanations for why that's the case, ranging from an insurer is not doing such a good job at cost containment, ranging from maybe they have a slightly sicker population or something about their network. Without that extra context, it's hard to reach some kind of conclusion. So that's just one example of just how it didn't quite hit the mark. And again, that's what our expectation was, but we wanted to at least see what would happen when you could establish the baseline. The best thing we could do moving forward on that is just what Commissioner Kelly alluded to, which is to pull in relevant information. You do this same thing next year, but pull in relevant information from the All Claims, All Payer database, which has much more robust data. It can create some of that context. And then best of all, from a detail perspective, the insurers have already reported it, so then they don't have to report anything additional, and that's just less paperwork and all that kind of stuff. You can't just press a button and make that happen. We learned that as we started to dig in. There are some data manipulations that have to get done, interagency cooperation, privacy issues, and so it's not something that you can just snap your finger and make happen. But it is true that the division is trying to figure that out with some of the relevant agencies, and if there was one point where advocates, lawmakers could support the division in trying to just, you know, get that to move as robustly and as quickly as possible, we think it would be that, because that could really make a big difference on the big picture kind of thing that we're trying to do.
speak to the choir.
Yes, we've been working on that without much success for quite a long time. All right, any questions? All right, thank you very much for your testimony. I'll let everybody get back on the road to their homes. And we anything, Chana, for the good of the order? We are adjourned.
I have one question for you.
Anything, Chana, for the good of the order? We are adjourned.